This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This week, the Education Select Committee said that Ofsted and the government needed to rebuild trust in the way in which English schools are inspected and recommended big changes. This intervention follows months of news coverage of the death of Ruth Perry, the head teacher who killed herself following an Ofsted inspection at her primary school. The coroner ruled that the Ofsted report had contributed to her death. We're not going to explore that case, but we are going to ask a broader question about school inspections. How well actually is Ofsted doing? And how, for the benefit of teachers, parents and pupils, could it improve? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start by finding out why Ofsted was set up in the first place and what it was meant to do. Here with me is Sam Friedman, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Government. Sam Friedman, before we get going, let's be clear. Ofsted inspects a whole lot of institutions, including, I think, nurseries and social care settings. But you and I are just going to focus on schools. So if you could just tell us which schools Ofsted has responsibility for.
Sure. Ofsted is responsible for all the schools in England. Their primary business, most of their money and effort is spent on state schools.
And is there an Ofsted equivalent in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland?
They each have their own inspectorate. They all work quite differently from Ofsted, but they do school inspection in each nation of the UK.
Take us back to before Ofsted actually existed in the 1970s and 80s. When I was at school, there was no such thing. How were schools assessed back then?
So there wasn't really any direct assessment of schools by central government. There was a inspectorate, Her Majesty's Inspectorate, which had existed since the early Victorian period. But it was sort of used by government to sort of give it general information about the sort of performance of the school system and used by local authorities to give it information about schools. But there was no sort of formal process of saying this school isn't up to scratch or not. And it was really up to local authorities at that point to say, we think this school isn't good enough or we think it's fine. And I think that was very frustrating to central government, who felt that a lot of local authorities weren't tough enough on their own schools and weren't upholding standards properly.
And once they'd been in a school, what would the inspectors do and what would people do with what work the inspectors had done in those schools?
So they'd write a report, as now, but it wasn't made public. It wasn't available to parents or future parents. And there was no sort of sanction attached to it.
What was it about the education system in the period before Ofsted was created that led government and others to think that such a body was necessary?
Well, there was a sense, and I think this was sort of across, this wasn't just sort of Conservatives, this was across the piece politically, that the provision of education was very patchy. There were obviously very good schools, but there were also very weak ones, and it was sort of felt that they were very concentrated, particularly in inner cities. You had some particularly big scandals about individual schools where behaviour was very bad and which have got a lot of local press coverage. And that led to a sense that something needed to be done to create a national sense of standards. And this was done in a variety of ways. We had a national curriculum introduced. We had national testing introduced, and we had Ofsted introduced. And this was all about sort of saying we want a level that schools have to meet, a bar that schools have to meet, and we want a consistent way of measuring whether they are hitting that bar, and one that is public and transparent to create that sense of accountability.
Now, you talked about how the inspector's reports began to be published, but then this decision is made to take a big step further and create this much bigger body. When did that happen and who took that decision?
So it happened in 1992. It was the major government that made the final call, although it had been something that people had been talking about for a few years before that. And the sort of idea was to say, OK, we want this. Publishing reports is fine, but actually we want to change what school inspection is about. It's no longer just about giving some information to the school, to the local authority. It's about this national, consistent and public bar of what's an acceptable level of education. And to do that, we need to change the whole culture. So we're going to create a new organisation and we're going to call it Ofsted.
Take us back to the first Ofsted reports when they came in. How much impact did they have?
They had a lot of impact because this was the first time the public were getting this sort of insight into how schools were sort of operating and what was the relative standard in different parts of the country. So that coverage in the 90s, when you started to get Ofsted reports and external testing, there's suddenly this sort of sense of, oh, wow, things are actually worse than we thought they were, because, you know, we can suddenly see the full picture. And that gives a real impetus to Tony Blair and his call for education standards.
Okay, so Ofsted actually seemed to turn a stone over and you discovered what was underneath. From the beginning, what were the consequences that were attached to certain kinds of Ofsted reports? Or were there no consequences initially?
So this has changed quite a bit over the lifespan of Ofsted. Initially, when it began, local authorities were still primarily the bodies responsible for schools. And so, you know, a poor Ofsted, it was published, it was public, but there was no automatic consequence to it. Over time, we've seen this shift towards central government taking much more of a direct role in schools and intervening in individual schools. That started towards the back end of the major government with Gillian Shepherd as Education Secretary, and then continued under Tony Blair, David Blunkett, his first Education Secretary, and then Andrew Adonis, all were sort of very interested in being more directly interventionist and weren't happy with the performance of many local authorities. So we saw the rise of academy schools, which are outside of local authorities, and central government has taken on more and more powers to directly intervene in every school in the country if it gets a bad Ofsted. So the position now is that if you get a grade four Ofsted, almost automatically the leadership will be changed in a school. But that wasn't the case when it was first created.
And taking us back to those early days of Ofsted, can you remember the first instance when government did decide to directly intervene as a consequence of an Ofsted report?
Well, I think probably the most famous early case was Hackney Downs in 1996, which became an emblematic school where Hackney Council were trying to defend it, a Labour Council were trying to defend it, and you had a Tory government trying to close the school saying this isn't good enough, we've got this terrible Ofsted report, we've got other information showing the school is failing. It was eventually closed and it was reopened a bit later as Mossbourne Academy and is now one of the most successful schools in the country. So it's quite a sort of emblematic case study of this shift from local to central government.
From the beginning, were there problems with the relationship between Ofsted and the teaching profession?
Yes. So right from the start, you had unions who were very sceptical of this sort of more aggressive accountability, both in terms of school inspection and in terms of more exams and assessments. And they felt it was going to be used by government to attack them, to make their lives harder. So you've always had this sort of core tension. And I think that's true in almost every sector. You know, the body that holds you accountable is not going to be popular. So, yes, that's been there from the start and I think has grown as a result of these consequences on schools becoming more and more significant over time, to the point where a bad Ofsted will now sort of more or less mean you lose your job as a head teacher or senior leader. That sort of growth in pressure has led to the tension getting bigger over the years.
Sam Friedman, that's how Ofsted was born and how it developed. Let's now find out how it does what it does. John Jerram is Professor of Education and Social Statistics at UCL. John Jerram, when a school's inspected, what exactly happens? And what I mean by that is who pitches up, how much warning do you get, and how long are they going to be on the premises for?
Yeah, so it depends partly on the type of inspection and the size of the school, but it's typically somewhere between 2 and 5 inspectors turn up, and they're usually at the school for roughly around 2 days. Historically, there were huge teams that turned up that were even more than that, and they were on the premises for a lot longer. So actually, this is scaled down now compared to previously.
How much warning do schools get that they're on their way?
Typically not very much. Over the last, you know, few years, it's usually the day or a couple of days before or whatever. So it's not a lot of time at all.
So the inspectors have pitched up at your school. What do they do when they're there?
They do several activities. They talk to staff, they talk to parents, they talk to pupils, they survey all those groups as well. And they do things like lesson observations. So go around the classes with the head teacher and other members of staff to observe lessons. They'll check curriculum plans. They'll do things called deep dives, where they pick a small number of subjects, quite often maths and English, and they really kind of scrutinise the curriculum there, what it's intended to do, how it's sequenced and how it's delivered in the classrooms.
And what is in the report?
The report basically summarises the evidence that the inspectors gathered during the inspection. It is very much a flavour. The reports are now actually pretty short compared to kind of the much wider evidence base that they collect. But it will now talk about what the school's doing well, what it's not doing so well, how it can improve, things like that.
We're all used to, of a certain generation, getting a particular kind of school report with things like must do better and fails to pay attention in class. When you say these reports are shorter, are they short in that kind of a way?
A typical Ofsted report for a full inspection is now really 2 or 3 pages long, and the rest is kind of background details about the school or whatever.
Now, how often do schools get inspected?
It depends. So outstanding schools for a long period of time haven't been inspected. So you have some outstanding schools that are out there now that haven't had an inspection for 10 or 12 years or so. But Ofsted is now kind of prioritising those for re-inspection. For most schools, it's typically every 3 or 4 years, but there's some exceptions to that. So, for instance, schools that are deemed to be inadequate, they have things called monitoring visits from Ofsted, which aren't kind of full inspections, but they're kind of a progress check for how they're doing.
If you've not been checked for 10 to 15 years and you've been outstanding, how does anybody know you're still outstanding?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And I think that's why a lot of people now look back at the exemption for outstanding schools and think it was a mistake, just because in 10 or 15 years, the school can and probably has completely changed. The leadership's almost certainly changed. The staff body's changed. The local area may have changed as well. No one actually thinks if you've got an outstanding rating that's 10, 12 years old, that necessarily that reflects the school right now.
I have to say, I'm slightly surprised by this, John, because I would have thought that was obvious.
I agree. The exemption was initially brought in when austerity was kind of at the grips of the country, and it was a way of prioritising resources to target other schools which were in greater need of inspection. But in hindsight, it probably went too far. And I think it's a good thing that Ofsted are now going back and re-inspecting these schools.
In the reports, the schools are graded, what, in 4 different grades?
So there are 4 grades that you can get from a graded Ofsted inspection: outstanding, good, requires improvement, or inadequate. Outstanding, which is typically about 15% of schools, 15 to 20%, the vast majority get rated as good, so about 70%, around 10% requires improvement, and only around 3% or so receive the inadequate grade.
Now let's talk about what it is they're actually measuring, the inspectors. What is it? Is it the quality of the education?
So there's 4 broad areas. The first is the quality of the education. The second is behaviours and attitudes of pupils. Third is their personal development. And fourth is the school leaders' management. And there's also a kind of note on safeguarding, whether safeguarding is effective or not. So it's essentially a binary outcome, yes or no.
Could you be really good at one of those categories and not very good in the rest of the 3 and still get an outstanding?
Some of the areas are limiting judgments or have been limiting judgments. So, for instance, you could have outstanding quality of education, but if you fall down on safeguarding, or if you fall down something like leadership and management, it can bring down your entire grade to, for instance, inadequate.
If a parent thinking about where they should send their child, insofar as they've got any choice, sees good or outstanding across a school, what should they take from that?
I don't personally think it's that useful to parents in selecting a school. It doesn't feel very useful because of the time lag. If you take an average school that's been like inspected once every 4 years, then actually, on average, that judgment's going to be 2 years old when you're making your decision. It's going to be about another year or so till your child actually attends there. Why I think we have to be a bit cautious is this is largely opinion, or at least a decent chunk of it is opinion and views formed. A different inspector or a different team of inspectors could go in on a different day, observe different things and come to different conclusions and different judgments.
John, what can we say about the relationship between how a school is graded, outstanding, good, etc., and what, let's say, the outcome for children will be academically?
So I think the presumption is amongst a lot of parents that you would expect to see a strong association between going to an outstanding school and then how your child will do in their GCSEs and later life. Actually, that relationship is really surprisingly weak. Once you take into account differences in background factors of who attends the different schools, you actually don't see much of a relationship between going to a better school as rated by Ofsted and things like GCSE outcomes, but also kind of labour market outcomes as well. So things like pay, probability of receiving benefits and things like that. So actually that relationship is really a lot weaker than many people would assume.
Is there any way of measuring whether Ofsted itself is doing a good job?
One thing that I would argue is what's one of their primary responsibilities is for doing the inspections. So they should be responsible for ensuring that those inspections are as valid, reliable and consistent as possible. I just don't think Ofsted has done enough work on that over the last 10, 20, even 30 years since it was first created. My own research has tried to look into this, and we found some evidence for primary schools that there's different judgments awarded by different inspectors, small differences, very small differences in terms of gender, more in terms of the inspector's employment relationship with Ofsted. So Ofsted employs both kind of permanent members of staff to do the inspections and part-time members of staff as well. And you kind of see big differences between the judgments that those groups reach.
John Jerrim. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the recent one on the crisis in local government and the one about the threat of the Israel-Gaza war becoming a regional conflict. Now, back to Ofsted. We know where it came from and what it does and what it doesn't do. But does it need significant improvement? And if so, how? Here to explore this with me are Carol Willis, Chief Executive at the National Foundation for Educational Research, and Colin Diamond, Professor of Educational Leadership at the University of Birmingham. Colin Diamond, can we start with something that's puzzled me? I had assumed that Ofsted inspections were mostly about teaching, but it turns out that quite a lot turns on safeguarding. What is safeguarding?
So safeguarding ranges through from making sure you are fully compliant, that everyone who works in the school is registered accordingly, through to what we see in the classrooms, in the playground, the behaviour of the children, and it all needs to be safe.
So would, for instance, online bullying by other school children, is that safeguarding?
Yes, absolutely. In the era of social media, inspectors do discover and unearth examples of cyberbullying. This needs to be reported to the school and, in some cases, other safeguarding agencies. Yeah, it's as important as physical bullying in the playground.
So it is absolutely possible for a school to be excellent in terms of what it teaches and how it teaches and actually to fall down significantly on safeguarding.
This has happened relatively recently. Some quite, as it were, prestigious schools with high pupil student attainment have been dropped into the inadequate grade because of issues to do with bullying, safeguarding, particularly for girls online. That's a good example.
Right. Colin, thanks very much for that. Carol, can we broaden this out now? From your perspective, What does Ofsted currently do well, and where has it improved in recent years?
There is a lot of support for the current education inspection framework introduced in 2019, which has a greater focus on the curriculum and a reduced focus on performance data alone. And Ofsted has been responsive to recent criticism, which is very positive. Sir Martin Oliver, the new chief inspector who started earlier this month, has signalled a number of positive changes going forward. And this includes committing to greater transparency, more dialogue with the sector, and recognising the need to take more account of the impact of inspections on teacher workload and well-being. So I think that bodes well for the future.
Colin Diamond, what's your view?
If we go back to when Ofsted started in the 90s, there was considerably less information and data available to parents, to the public. Now, every school has pretty high quality websites. The Department for Education, you can dig into lots of detail there. So the relative importance of Ofsted in terms of providing that information through inspection has dropped considerably. And some people question, what is it you are actually inspecting, given we have so much desktop information about how a school is performing?
I'd like to ask you both this. We've heard a lot of criticism about Ofsted giving one-word judgments or really kind of summary judgments. Carol, is there a better way of doing it?
Well, it is difficult to sum up everything a school does in one phrase. So I have some sympathy with those who are calling for the removal of inspection grades altogether. However, it's essential to consider the wider implications and avoid unintended consequences. Inspection grades are used in various parts of the system, including in decisions about turning schools into academies and triggering other kinds of support. So something would need to replace graded judgments in the wider accountability and support system if they were removed. And we would also need to ensure that Ofsted reports, report cards, as some people are calling them, didn't become overly complex for parents or risk falling back onto the performance data alone with the absence of those overall judgments.
Colin Diamond.
Single word judgments are brutal and in some cases act as a trapdoor for academisation. So it's uniquely high stakes we have in the English system. Nobody wants to be wading through massive, massive reports to get the essence of what the school's about, but there has to be a happy medium in there somewhere.
Carol, can I just understand this point about academisation so that I've absolutely got it in my head? Is it the case, therefore, that if you fall below a certain standard as a school, you are effectively incorporated into somebody else's academy or into somebody else's educational structure?
So schools who receive an inadequate judgment, who are local authority run schools, are turned into an academy and placed with a multi-academy trust, a wider group of schools to help support their improvement. If they receive two requires improvement judgments in a row, then they may be subject to that academy order. Schools that are already academies, if they receive those low grades, may be moved to a different multi-academy trust that can then support them to improve. The challenge in both of those cases, not only is that turning a school into an academy is not a silver bullet, it can take time to implement, and there are only a limited number of high-performing multi-academy trusts who can take on these schools and provide them with sufficient support to improve. So there are limitations in the whole of the support system, including that key plank of academisation.
One of the things that strikes me is that the process seems to end in many ways with the report. And the question is then how the school can be helped to improve, but Ofsted doesn't have the responsibility for doing that. Is there an argument for having, I don't know, some kind of extra agency which says, I don't know, a school improvement agency which follows up on what Ofsted has discovered? Carol, what do you think?
Well, I think the first point to make is that Ofsted absolutely isn't a school improvement agency and shouldn't be, because that raises all sorts of conflicts of interest in relation to its role in inspection. But I absolutely agree that the support framework itself needs to be very carefully reviewed by the government. There is a lot of concern in the sector that the support available is not sufficient, not tailored to the school needs, and not available quickly enough. Now, there's an interesting model that NFER has evaluated, used in some African countries, which has had some very positive impacts on the quality of education there, where school inspection experts take part in the inspection process alongside government inspectors. The government inspectors then leave, maintaining their independence, and the school improvement agency works closely with the school over the coming months to help them address the issues identified in the inspection. That kind of model would require a lot more resource, but it's certainly something to be considered in an English context.
Carol, finally, this discussion is happening in the context of what you might describe as a sort of widespread, I wouldn't say it's kind of anti-Ofsted feeling, but highly critical of Ofsted feeling. Are you worried at all that there's the temptation to try and return to the days when schools were not subject to this high level of inspection, i.e. the days before 1992?
I hope not. That would be a huge step backwards. I think we need an inspection system to provide a more rounded picture of a school. We need to continue with a risk-based approach to identifying the schools that are inspected and how frequently they're inspected, because there are limited resources. And there's always going to be a trade-off between frequency and depth of inspections. We may not have the balance right at the moment, but that's always going to be part of the system.
Colin, do you agree?
I do agree. I am no abolitionist. I think pretty much everybody I work with in the profession recognises the importance of inspection as one key ingredient of school improvement. What the profession is looking for is a more sophisticated system that will actually add value to how schools can improve. We don't want to return to the pre-92 days. When I was working in schools in London then, there were huge variations, which were quite unacceptable. And there were too many schools where, frankly, if you have children, you wouldn't necessarily want them in those schools. Things have moved forward for a whole range of reasons. And I think inspection has been part of that process. So let's get to the next level, a more mature system, which reflects the changes that have happened in schools more broadly and becomes part of a school improvement system rather than what's experienced in many cases as the kind of hit and run exercise.
Colin Diamond there with Carol Willis. My thanks to them and to Sam Friedman and John Jerram. My conclusion, there may be problems with Ofsted, but from what I've heard, we still need it, and finding the solutions to those problems seems perfectly possible. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Nick Holland, Kirsty Knight and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineer was Hal Haynes. The editor is Richard Barden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Thirty years ago, Britain's farms were hit by an epidemic of an infectious brain disorder. They called it mad cow disease. I'm Lucy Proctor. And in The Cows Are Mad from BBC Radio 4, I tell the story of a very weird time in our history.
The media started calling me the mad cow professor.
Mad cow disease rampaged through Britain, first killing cows and then humans. And the thing is, after all this time, nobody knows for sure where mad cow disease originally came from.
And the general feeling is that we will never know the answer.
Subscribe to The Cows Are Mad on BBC Sounds.
Thank you.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.